30 of Japan.
But yeah, I mean, I wondered whether they were related to trade or for who were they defending themselves against, or was it just a thing that they felt they needed to?
Well, I don't know. You see, the way I think about it, in this part of the world with hill forts and in the Iron Man that's on the hill forts, you've got to have proto-urban organization. In other words, we're looking at a society which is on the verge of nationhood. If you look in Gaul with the attack of Caesar and all the rest of it, the Vercingetorix, the reason why the Celtic nations failed was that they weren't organized. They hadn't achieved this nationhood, which we saw in the rest of the civilizations in Greece. We find all that lot beginning to build up into a sense of nationhood based upon the city-state. Now, if we come back to the prehistory of this part of the world, in order for the agricultural system to be as successful as Caesar tells us it was, and our research underlines that it could have been, then you're looking at a process which says you must have an infrastructure which allows that to work. Hiya, Mick.
Hiya.
You've got to have the service industries. Now, the places for service industries are not on the land, because they're non-producers. They are producers in the sense they make objects and all the rest of the stuff, but you've got all the smiths and all the wrights. They're there. They've got to be there because we've got the archaeological evidence for it. But they're non-producers. Where do you put them? I mean, are they going to be in a hovel in the middle of nowhere, or are they going to be in places like Danebury? If you've got a surplus production from all these little farms, you've got to concentrate this stuff before you move it. Where do you concentrate it? In the service zone. And what do you get at Danebury? You get vast numbers of storage units, whether they're pits or whether they're four-post structures. Right? The place is absolutely ram-jam full of these bloody things. There's one street that Cumbria suggests is lined with granaries. You know, we could call it Emo Street or Granary Street or Red Road or whatever, you know. But the point is, it's there. Now, in order to make sense of the hill fort, I think we're looking at a proto-urban situation where the service industries are being concentrated in a location. See? Now then you come to the next bit. Why so many ditches and banks? Why are they so impressive? Why do we make our towns impressive to this very day? We are better than you lot. We people from Wellingborough look down upon you people from Luton because we've got a nicer town and we've got better walls and better ditches and banks. And really you're a bunch of peasants. People in Luton say, well, we've got to do something about this. And it's all about competition. Because there are only, what is it, come on, you know this, you've been a student subsequent to me, Breeden Hill in Worcestershire, the one that your man dug up down in Somerset, what's the name of the hill fort down there that he dug up?
Cadbury,
South Cadbury. Right, South Cad. And one or two others that escape me to the present time that show evidence of Celt stuffing Celt. Mm. Otherwise, Roman stuffing Celts. You know, it's old Vespasian and his 20 little forts in a campaign. Yeah? Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
Where's the other evidence? And you've got hill fort by hill fort, hot hill and whatever it is.
That's right, they overlook each other, don't they?
Yeah, they overlook. What are they doing? They're saying, me, I'm better than you. And that strikes me as being an overall. You can drive coaches and horses through a whole argument, I suspect, but it seems to me a better overall picture if you're going to make the hypothesis that it was a warrior aristocracy.
So
trying to see how whether there are any aspects of what we know on the island that perhaps doesn't fit there.
I was going to say, if you've got promontory forts and places like this, does that mean that at this site we are looking at primarily a farm, an agricultural,
or are you looking at a kind of palace?
Well, this is the other side of things. Don't sort of think of promontory forts as being, you know, the
done there. It's not good news.
Not good news.
Not good news.
You can't move very
anywhere else.
In any direction.
It hurts nasty. And you're wet and cold and fundamentally miserable. Mm. And that is not a good way to fight anybody.
But I think all these discussions are going to be very pertinent to what the interior could look like.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
what impression we give to people, whether these are farmers just surviving or they're successful, is, you know.
But I think that our fundamental assumption is that these guys are successful.
Yeah.
Well,
I think if we make any other assumption, then it's a nonsense.
Yeah.
You know, and you could almost raise that argument from the size of the post.
Yeah.
I know it's tortuous, but you follow the logic.
Yeah.
You know, and if you were to turn around and say, well, we've got all these Promontory Hill ports and all the rest of it, which is fine. This is sort of pointing outwards and saying, you know, we are tough guys here. And then you look on the interior and you've got these damn great stretches if Verser is right. Then these must represent the palaces, and the village scenario is that which has emerged out of people. Or the small farm unit, or the peasant. And what you will have inside this, again, you can play about with the Irish legends, if you like. And if you were going to put a theatre in there, you've got your audience here, you've got your storyteller, you can even indulge in smellies if you must, you know, roast pork or roast whatever, over the fire, or boiled meat and all the rest of this stuff. And you've got exactly the scenario of the palace. And in the Iliad, again, sorry to hark back to the classical world, but I think this is referring, written in the 8th century, referring to the 10th century BC, there's a discussion between two of the heroes outside the walls of Troy, which runs more or less as follows. One says, yeah, Jesus Christ, we've been here for 10 years, and we've done fuck all. What the hell are we planning? The Trojans are still in there, we're still out here, and at home, I've got the most gorgeous wife, I've got a concubine, I've got a palace, my children, and my lands run with milk and honey. Why are we here? And his mate turns down to him and says, look, Buster, the reason we're here is because at home you've got a palace and a beautiful wife and your land is run with milk and honey. It's because the rest of the peasantry is actually working their socks off to give you all that stuff to go and fight their battles. Because the Trojan War is about economics. This is every war. And I think that when we look at the island, we are looking at that kind of exercise, the sustaining of your man. You know, in Irish you call him your man. He's the guy that we tug everything to. And if you think of the juxtaposition between the Irish evidence and the Isle of Man, you're beginning to look at it. I still think it's here in England, abundantly. Starting from another angle, if you accept the hypothesis that politics is the handmaiden of economics, then we've got to ask ourselves the question, why did Romans bother with invading the UK in the first place? And the answer comes back, economically, it made absolutely first class sense. Because this country enjoyed, despite the present year, the best climate, has the best variety of soil, good natural cereal, for the whole of the Western Europe. If Caesar, talking 100 years prior to the invasion of Rome, says that we were exporting grains to the Celts on the continent, this only serves to underline that this place was really the breadbasket of Western Europe. Now, if you've got the inertia of empire needs to be moved, and it is the inertia of empire, then it's got to be a jolly good economic reason to do that. And what they wanted, in my opinion, is simply Southeast England, running a line from, if you like, Bristol, up to Yorkshire, and then forget it. The rest of the bloody place we don't want. we don't need. All we want is the rich zone. And the rich zone is the zone that produces the farinaceous diet on which the empire lives. The rest of them we can trade with too. We'll get the leather from them for the shields and the shoes and the army and all the rest of it, because that's where it all is. And of course, in terms of production in this country, agricultural production, you can stay with that line, the walking street, not the walking street, the Fosway. You can stay with the Fosway and say, northwest of that line is livestock production. Southeast of that line is arable production. And having got that far, then one is extremely important because it's the staple food stuff. The other one is something we can trade with. We can live with buying it. But the other stuff, the last thing we want to do is buy that, we need it. And you see, you can go to the 3rd century Odyssey, which is a wretched century it is. The Roman army on the Rhine, the R-A-O-R, runs out of food. Where do they get it from? They get it from emergency supplies. A ship from here, the Roman army on the Rhine. It's still highly productive, and yet one suspects that the person looking at a master slave timber, then the production levels will naturally have gone down during the Roman occupation. In fact, there is evidence to suggest that livestock production became economically more viable than grain production, because it costs less than human power. Because if you extend the franchise and you turn people into Roman citizens, which they did, then you've got to pay the going rate for that. And you've got to put into that the whole principle of investment in the provinces in order to make a capital cash return. In other words, they're doing exactly the same thing as we do on the protein base. Nothing changes. It's the same structure, it's the same investment system, and it's the same kind of process where you squeeze in the furthermost parts of your power structure in order to feed the center.
So you actually have, quite a stratified society on the island, quite successful, able to support this sort of thing, able to construct this sort of thing, calling those resources, which was successful in a peaceful way,
yeah,
and not so successful to attract outside interest.
Yeah. It's all good. Why not? And in terms of Ireland, you've actually got all the benefits of the life of allowing the society to flourish and get richer and richer, and you can still protect it.
Mm.
It's when you're stuck in the middle of the South Downs that you get channeled to the Great Hunt.
Yeah.
See, added to which you would be on Wales. If not the Pale, but if you're standing down here and you look that way, what have you got? A bunch of Welsh idiots between you and the Isle of Man. And consequently, this little enclave on the Isle of Man, well, thrives and its own traditions, its own myths and legends, as we know how to know.
Mm.
sorts of things about. That is the main.
I think there's a difference between somebody's just put the tools down and walked off site and brand new in the sense that, on the interior there, that's something we need to try and pick up on, is that once you've built one of these, from the experience of having built a number and done things inside them, is how quickly the timber ages and how it looks after a certain period.
Well smoked.
Yeah, how quickly do those things occur? Because we have got quite a time scale, if you like, from the point of this building having been built to the point at which...
How are you going to light it?
That's, again, we have a sum of money to do it, set aside. We want it to be, the thoughts today have been that it will essentially be pretty dark, and everything will be lit from low level.
There is an ambient light that you get inside these things.
Yeah, that's another thing I wanted to look at, see what that... A lot of the thought that has been to date is that because we are... This is a theatrical reconstruction. It is not a genuine reconstruction. It is theatre.
Yeah.
So we would set it probably at night time, and that... this idea of storytelling, that we would use that, but perhaps between two different generations, where we could get this idea of, without lecturing the visitor, we can actually talk about the structure of the society without, again, being very specific.
Yeah.
And it could be between, say, a young boy and an old man or whatever at night.
It allows us to create, there's about 10 or 15 other areas, some of which are visually very dramatic. We want this to be a very quite audio-based, but also to have this very accurate reconstruction as the setting for it. So it wants to look lived in, but there's nothing worse than building a new structure and then trying to make it look old, because it never looks old in a genuine way.
Yeah, I don't see the point in that, in a sense, because, again, if you use the stories from the Irish sagas and you focused as your primary sort of story, the champion's portion, which this lends itself to, then it's going to be a new house. Because your man actually built a new house, especially for the exercise. Now, the other point about that, if we're going to use timbers which you squared off, they are going to discolour naturally through time anyway.
Mm.
Because if we use green timbers, they're going to change the nature of their appearance year on year.
Yeah.
You know, they're not going to end up like a piece of deal, which, unless you do something to it, I mean, these things have got juices in there, and those juices are actually going to change colour.
Mm.
And they'll change colour disproportionately.
Right. Mm.
So there's that side to it. I would be inclined to go for it as a new structure, which is going to age as the museum itself ages.
Mm. But, I mean, I would assume that if you built this structure, you would still bring with you a lot of material from your old house, which would be worn, tatty, and would have the signs of life that come with it. You wouldn't actually...
It's a presumption, you see, that you're actually building this from an old house. I would suspect if our previous hypotheses are in any way sensible, then this is an expression of wealth and power. Local wealth and power. You know, this is the squirearchy. And by the same token, I would suggest a house of that scale is going to have relatively few people inside it. Whereas a smaller house has got a greater probability of wall-to-wall people.
Mm. Mm.
Which is the opposite of what the visitor will expect, which I quite like.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I don't think they built a big house because there's a lot of people.
Mm. Mm.
But you don't build big houses because you've got a lot of people. You build big houses to tell the other people that you're rich.
Yeah, you've got lots of space. You can afford the space.
Wealth buys space.
Yeah.
Which is why I live in a tiny cottage.
Actually, going back to this question of lighting, I think we do need to look at, realistically, what sort of apertures would we have in terms of, if it is this massive turf cut,
then
did they have windows?
There's an argument whether there's a hole in the roof or it just seeps up through.
That's
any
right.
Well, it's always a problem. I just genuinely don't know whether you have windows or not. If you have windows, then essentially there are two arguments. If it's a double wing structure and we've got no problems if it's multiple wing, then you can afford to have windows. If it's a single wing structure, then you can't have a window because you're actually destroying the tensile strength of the wall. You know, that's a fundamental observation. But having said that, with this kind of structure, there's no reason why you shouldn't have windows.
You only need windows if you're doing things inside it that require...
Well, we require light, you see. Mm. And if you think in terms of a society which is illiterate, well, you don't even have to think in those terms. For crying out loud, when I was a child, very small child, you're knocking on as well. Do you remember candles?
I was brought up in a house in Dorset with no electricity and no water.
Right,
I went
my grandparents were exactly the same thing.
To university.
You know, and you went to bed with a candle.
Yeah.
That was normal.
You only worked within... I spent all my time before going to college working within that distance of a light if it was any chance.
Which is why
dark.
You wear glasses. Yeah, why I wear contact lenses, because our eyes were screwed up at the age between 15 and 18. We spent far too much time in lousy life. Why, you guys have no problems.
That does actually lead on to two other questions. I mean, we've been toying with this idea, not just here, but elsewhere in the One House, for instance, itself, about what sort of activities can one expect to take place.
Bearing in mind, he's
always pissing down the rain outside
quite
a lot.
Did they do their weaving indoors or out of doors, or prepare their vegetables indoors or out of doors, or leak their curing skins all?
I think probably a vast amount of this goes on indoors simply because of the weather.
Yeah.
One of the biggest problems we've got, and that pervades the whole of Iron Age studies, is the fact that about 20 years ago, an awful lot of archaeologists buggered off to Africa and spent a fortnight out there and came back and rewrote the Iron Age, both in terms of kinship and chieftainship and organisation of social orders, and using the argument that they lived in roundhouses as the direct parallel. And it's so much crap. Because in Africa, you live outside, you sleep inside. You want it smoky because mosquitoes don't. And if you don't want to be bitten to death, the best place to sleep is in a smoky atmosphere. So you're just underneath the smoke line, and all the nasty flying bugs are above it. It is normal. I've done this in Africa myself, and it works. But outside is wonderful. The sun shines, and you can do anything you want to do. Including brew beer, you know, but come back to England, and apart from 1976 and 1995, you know, you're a bit pushed. You're continually being wetted on by God, which is why your production levels of cereals are so high. Because green England is a green and pleasant land. The only reason it's green is because it depends on. So consequently, vast numbers of these activities are going to go on inside. And there are many things, especially things like curing skins, which are better done inside. You know, you would probably have a through draft. You would do a lot of the curing of the skins in the doorways because you want a gentle through draft. And it puts their nip a bit, but then again, I suppose
nobody really cares. Who cares?
You know.
I was just thinking back to this loom thing, and then I was thinking, like, talking about the Iliad, and I was wondering if it would be appropriate if we have here a palace for all the ladies of the house, like Penelope, to go off in some good quality.
Have you ever watched an old lady knit?
No, it's all in the head. It's counting. You don't need to see what you're doing.
You don't see what you're doing.
Yeah.
And similarly, when you watch Turkish peasants weaving Turkish carpets, they do it in the virtual dark.
Well,
only when the pattern is complicated do they ever need light. But then they count the older ones that have been making Turkish carpets of their design forever. They know. And the other thing is, every Turkish carpet has got a mistake or two in it. Because if not, you challenge the government. You create a perfect Turkish carpet, and it will be hated by everybody. But if it has a little time to stay in
place,
then that's perfectly adequate.
I'm doing some work in the Middle East at the moment. We've had some ceramic tiles made.
Yeah.
And one has been made with the bolt in.
That's right.
Automatically. Don't even have to ask the
yeah. You don't have to ask why or anything. It would be an offence, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Too close to perfection.
So, you know, there's no reason why, you know, sitting beside the fire, you shouldn't have a loom or whatever. Mm. In fact, this has got to be the focal point, besides which your seats are there, so
that's, right.
That's where it's all happening.
There is there's a danger in this. Either it looks too empty and it doesn't interest the visitor enough, or there is a tendency to pack it with so much stuff it doesn't
it
work
it,
for that reason.
It
and
ruins.
It's finding that balance between the two to make it work.
But I would suggest that that stage is so easy to play about with. The fundamental element is only the fire, the hearth.
Mm.
After that, you can bugger about to your heart's content by bringing in, taking out.
You can bring the props in and take them out.
You know, and you can do it on visitor satisfaction levels, if you like.
Mm.
I mean, that's just the dressing on top, and it means nothing.
I think I've seen...
Or it means everything.
Yeah, this has two functions. One, which is when it's a sort of busy visitor day, it's part of the main visitor route, and it functions as one of the elements. But it also has an educational stage, which is where you might bring more props out, you know, and actually use it for demonstration and things.
But how long is the estimated visitor pause in this?
3 to 5 minutes.
So in other words...
I don't know if you forwarded sets of drawings of the whole building. I'll send you a set. This is a huge undertaking. I mean, it goes from the Celts to... 20th century, essentially, and it's about the island's history from its Celtic tradition to its current maritime tradition and Peel Castle. This is one of 20 spaces this big being undertaken.
Yeah.
There's the Viking longships being
rehoused
as if it's just being beached.
Yeah.
Just landing and things. This is very important, but it's one of a step, and we can't, I think, within the sort of... The media visitor, there's two other elements before this, which are, if you like, part of the Celtic tradition. The first one is just a quick bit of AV glitz, really, just to say the Celts thought of themselves and were very important, you know, and were not what everybody looks back on them or the general public. The second one is that model area, which is just an area really to get people orientated and settled down. Then there's this. They then go to this into a small gallery which deals with the Celtic religion and balancing it against the coming Christianity, because that's so important to the Isle of Man and Christian churches. Then we get to the Vikings. Then there's a reconstruction of a Viking longhouse. Then there's a major audiovisual theatre which is talking about the Celtic the Viking Christian stones of man. Then we've got the longship. Then they go upstairs, and then they start the 20th. Then they start with the fishing and maritime tradition.
Yeah. So really, the impact that this has got to have on the visitor is pure scale.
One of the things we've
got to go into this.
One of the key.
Jesus Christ.
We never thought one of these. You know, the one reason for us putting the model is because people look at models and think, God, that's only small. It's a sort of tiddly little thing. Anybody could have built one of these. And one of these has got to be that you walk and you go in, and to look from one side to the other, which is the longest view we can get. People are going to go, how the hell does this stand up? You know,
The first thing I would chop is the model. What I would use is either a mural or even versus ground plan. I would not use a model because you would actually screw the psychology of the visitors.
Mm.
What you want, the impact that you need to get is the one which says, Jesus Christ, this is bloody enormous.
Mm.
If you produce a model, you kill that instantly.
You kill the scale.
You know, you put in people's minds, oh, it's art.
It's toy.
Yeah. tonight.
You can buy one.
Yeah, you can buy one at Hampton. And I think that would be a fundamental presentational error. Psychologically, I don't know. I mean, you guys are the experts at this. I'm just a mere amateur. I'm
also from an Iron Age farm, a visitor attraction.
I think it depends to some extent. I agree with it's how we present that model and what its function is.
Yeah. Quite frankly, I would chop it. It's three-dimensional. It's three-dimensional by definition.
That's bad.
Yeah. Hey.
Not necessarily.
I mean, let's say no. We were going to have sort of murals anyway. No,
but got that, I mean, for the sake of argument, and pump it up, jump, as big as it will stand.
Well, that's
or as big an area as you've got, and nothing else. Mm-hmm. And then they go from that into this. And you would kill instantly the scale problem. Because it worries the hell out of me that this whole principle of models, because they actually tell people an untruth.
Well, people in museums look at models, or anywhere, and look at models because they like the model.
Yeah.
They don't actually get you beyond the fact that they like the model.
Yeah. Which so is why use one?
Well, unless you've got no other, unless you're using it purely as a 3D diagram.
But a 3D diagram is telling the wrong story.
Yeah.
No matter how beautifully it's done, it's still telling a fundamental concept which doesn't transfer.
That's partially.
It does to you and I because we're trained to think in a scale. You know, if it's this big and it says it's a 1 to 10, boom. Hey, I understand that. You understand that. But does Joe Bloggs down the street understand that?
Most of my clients can't read plans.
Right. Well, you see, now you go down another route. There was a lovely thing on television in the Midlands yesterday, and they're naming streets, right? David Copperfield Avenue, and all the rest of it. And they went around the local public because somebody has complained they're going to call it Enid Blyton Corner. And so they went round and they asked the locals in this particular town, you know, do you know who Charles Dickens was? Never heard of him. You know, and they went down this route and they asked all these classic authors that nobody ever bloody reads, have you heard of Enid Blyton? Oh, yes! I remember Enid Blyton.
Well, how about
that? Yeah. Well, I mean,
there's lots of questions.
Lots of questions. That's why I don't get more of it.
Oh, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's, I think, the fun of my job, being sort of museum design, is that we force all the poor people who are like Andrew to make reality out of things, which doesn't happen. And at the end of the day, accuracy is very important, but the great thing is making the public enthusiastic about the subject and wanting them to, if they've seen this one and then they see your sign, they want to go to that one, or they go to that one and they want to go to this one. We're never going to tell them the complete story or get it 100% right. One of the best bits of my job is going through archaeologists' scripts and taking all the perhapses, maybes and could-bes out to make it vaguely comprehensible to the public. I mean, because otherwise you get, I had a great one which was, it's an important causewayed camp. I said, well, the public don't understand what a causewayed camp is and important comparatively. So why are we putting this site on display? Well, it's an important archaeological dig, but why is that important to the public? This was about a 4-month discussion to actually say, I want to know how I'm going to get the public interested in a causewayed camp.
Yeah.
I mean, right. And it's very difficult.
This is a ritual site.
For what?
Why?
But if you come from the other end and say, we don't know what it's for, but it must have been important, because if we calculate the amount of soil that was moved, it must have taken a lot of people a lot of effort. At least you've got a clue.
Yeah.
You know, you've got something that people can get a handle on, but if it's just a
an important causeway camp, you have to be butter all.
Yeah.
Why did the people think that?
Well, this is exactly the argument I was using against the model.
Okay.
It's exactly the same argument, but in different clothes.
I think there is a danger to believe that, I mean, if you put a model in the gallery or whatever, that the public think that that's what these people did first, and sort of almost like an architectural model. that's an argument
I'd like the pipes on the outside.
But I had that argument with Verulamium, though, once, that to some degree, as a culture, you do get delivered what your culture delivers to you. But I still believe the Romans had a sense of going to habitat, in one way or another, that their houses weren't just like that because you're a Roman, you have that mosaic. He wanted one because Mrs. So-and-so has
got
one
up the road.
Or whatever, that's or was right. A damn good salesman with a good book or whatever.
Yeah. But mosaics we know came in wallpaper books.
But I haven't seen a museum anywhere that treats the selection of Roman decoration as something that you would do for yourself. That you are there, you're having a new house built, and you've got to make some decisions.
Yeah.
Why isn't this you're saying that things repeat themselves, why can't we do it that way, which is make it human?
Just so happens we're building a Roman building.
Alright. I mean, I think that's just somebody's making decisions. I'm going to have a room there.
Yeah.
Yes, you're slightly copying, because we all do it. Nobody reinvents their own interior design. But great fun to actually have this idea, this couple standing there, and the salesman saying, well, which one do you want?
Yeah.
And an argument going on.
What, with gold tax?
Yes, that's right. And we can't afford that. We're going down to B&Q. Different level than actually what you can afford.
Yeah.
And it's not decisions are really no different.
Yeah.
But you wonder with this. I mean, I often just sit there and wonder. But whether the technology in the society is not flexible enough to allow people to make choices.
I genuinely don't know.
Is the pattern of these structures so repetitive that it almost is that you have a house, you have one of these?
I genuinely don't know. You see, these are atypical for a start.
Yeah.
And that's where we're coming in.
Yeah.
But when you come to the other round houses, they're now beginning to excavate in a more meticulous manner than ever before. And you get the interiors are actually distinguished one half from the other half. In one half you find lots and lots of artifacts, in the other half you find virtually none. So in other words, you're actually looking at activity zones within the structure.
Mm.
Now that in itself is fascinating, because up until recently a roundhouse is a roundhouse. Well, what do you do where?
Mm.
And now they're beginning to actually extract from this stuff working zones within the house, and they seem to be typical with a very small sample.
Mm.
They seem to be typically divided into two halves, so that the southeast half has got lots of artifacts in, and the northwest half doesn't. But the southeast half is where you've got the doorway, which is a logical exercise when you come to think about it. That's where most light is.
Which would mean that if we're taking the idea that
Where's the entrance?
Yours
is on the southwest,
which is where the prevailing wind comes from.
Jeez, so you've got a wind blowing at me, Jackie, all the time. Mm.
Or have you? Have you got
this tape that you're rubbing, I hope you're going to expurgate. Hey, Hazel? Promise?
Yep. Yeah.
But that's the sort of thing we're talking about with the windows, a single ring round house, and whether or not you can actually have them and so on. The same sort of question arises here, that once you get into multiple rings and so on, and possibly partitioning and so on, you may be able to create some sort of battle or whatever.
Oh yeah. Mm. Yes, that's right enough. Once you've got an upstanding structure.
But we were, I think, as you started talking about partition somehow, so the room is just wondering.
We're leaving that one for you.
Oh, great. But this whole idea of activity areas and perhaps specialist areas, maybe there is stabling gear partitioned off in some sort of way. Do you think
it's
that that's tenable, and B, how would you render it?
I think it's unlikely. And the reason I think it's unlikely is the same argument that you use for the lack of any other kind of evidence from the UK for stabling of animals inside. Insofar as the weather is never bad enough. The only reason for keeping livestock inside a building is because you've got 2 meters of snow. Mm. You know, well, as in...
Iceland and Greenland.
But you don't mean in northern France, you see, in the countryside, you can get often a meter, 2 meters of snow, and that's enough to get rid of all the sheep. They are not going to survive. And your cattle, similarly, are not going to survive, so you bring them in. Now, on the Isle of Man, as in central southern England, you've not got this problem. So why create an answer to it? We've also got another problem, insofar as roundhouses exist only in the United Kingdom, the Isle of Man, Ireland, and in northwest Spain. The rest of the building tradition is a rectilinear one. You know, it's an oddball exercise.
There's nowhere further east that a circular tradition.
The circular tradition actually does exist in the Mycenaean world. There are Tholos tombs. They're round. You will find the Lagian tombs on the Mindos Peninsula in Turkey. They're round. You will find various shepherd's huts subsequent to that time being built in circular form.
They're unusual.
They might be common in an area, but they're not writ large across the landscape. And if you look at the evidence for Greek houses, Hellenistic houses, they're mud-built and they're rectangular, two-room yards, often plastered and at the end of the day probably quite habitable, but they're small and they are in fact rectangular. So this insular, in inverted commas, tradition of building roundhouses is peculiar. And if you look at the Spanish stuff in Galicia, they're all small. And in Lusitania, vast numbers of them. There's one wondrous site at Monte Santa Tecla, which overlooks the Minho between Spain and Portugal, the River Minho. And there, you've got... Hi, Brian. You've got all sorts of little tiny houses forming streets and, you know, complexes all over the place inside a defended enclosure, like a hill fort. Stuff all over the mountain. And it's all interesting stuff, but, you know, the roundhouse principle is not continental.
So you would say that this is one open structure with very little division in it?
I didn't actually say that, but I think so. But you see, the problem comes in the excavation itself.
Yeah. I mean, the only thing that is odd to me is this differentiation on the rings between what's on the floor. That's me just looking at it. A non-archaeologist looking at it, thinking, but that's very odd.
And you could
that was stopping it kicking between the two.
Yeah.
Didn't it need to have something to stop it?
Yeah, otherwise it should overflow.
Yeah.
But how accurate is that? You know, is it real or is it perceived? Because on the other side, you've actually got the opposite.
It's a very odd one, yes, that's right.
You see, down here.
Is it to do with erosion?
Down there,
the
you've got
of
this
that?
Kind of
yeah.
spread, which is only in there. Yeah. I mean, is this some kind of, I would almost go down the route that we're actually looking at an enclosure with a palisade fence around it. And a double ring house inside it, lopsided though it might be. But bearing in mind it's got a clap roof, it doesn't matter. Because the angle of the roof is not that critical. But that would be a reinterpretation of what those were suggesting. And that's not the game we're trying to play at the minute. We're actually assuming that those is correct. And therefore, we're going to build a structure which is perceivably that big. I.e. 70 foot across. And what we're trying to do is create a situation where the visitors is impacted by that diameter.
So, yeah, I want them to be surprised that people could build at that time. I bet you didn't believe they could build something that big out of the material.
That's right. That's right. It's exactly the syndrome of being more complex than the Greek temple. You know, and that takes a gigantic step for our culture, because it's still based on the classical world. Mm-hmm. You know, really. Good Lord, the parson is wonderful. It is indeed a wonderful building, but it is essentially a very simple architectural deal.
It's what kids do with bricks, it's a signature.
Well, do you remember when we were kids, we were given the building blocks which made into a Greek temple. I've been trying now for ages in second-hand shops to find
one of those.
Because they came in wooden boxes, remember, and you've got pillars and Doric columns and everything. And capitals and pediments and...
You still get that sort of shape.
Yeah. It's all part of a classical world. You know, I'd love to get hold of all those buildings there. But I've never seen anybody find a kitty with a building sandwich from a creative around us. Have a lot of frustrated parents. But that itself is the whole message. It's the whole message.
Does it leave you as
go on.
It's almost like, you know, just a full of geodesic dome. It's a wonderful idea. It's extremely complex. It works well, but it's a dead end. You know, because it's too complex. It's too complex for the general world to actually pick up and develop.
In a sense, you see, but in that sense, you're dealing with perfect geometric forms, which is the silicon cone. I tell you, when you get into electrical, it'll become extendable by making lots of rectangles stick on it, in all cubes. We don't really have cubes in the sense, but they're always going to be cubes. It's going to be a cube later in product. But in terms of cylinders and cones, you're instantly confined by almost the perfection of these forms. Which is an architectural interest, anyway. But that's the way I thought of it.